Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. How are you doing, people of the regular chat? Today we are talking again with an old friend of ours, an academic agent, as part of our move to Odyssey. We finally have more freedom to speak with them again, and it's good to see you again, academic agent. How are you doing?
I'm very good. How are you doing, JF?
I'm doing great. Yeah, long time no see. You still live under the boot of Susan. Are you doing good? Do you need help, water, anything?
I don't know. I'm starting to get like, I'm like a Stockholm. I just am addicted to her leather stiletto boot, you know. I'm kind of like, but I don't know. Like I find it difficult to, people don't really move. So what I'm doing, JF, is I've actually started to, because I see the need that we need to maintain broad bases and need to make sure that we're basically uncancelable, right? So what I did just this week, actually, I started a new Substack. In fact, I started it like just last night.
Yeah, absolutely. I was looking at this wonderful Substack. A lot of people are headed there. Do we know what will be their attitude with cancel culture and censorship?
Well, from what I've seen, they're quite good. And there's a lot of interest in people over there. You know, the take up for mine has been pretty good so far. I mean, I've been on there for literally a day and I've got, you know, a good number of paid subscribers already, which is great to see. I did hear rumors that Eric Stryker was banned from there.
That wouldn't be surprising. There's a big question whether it's at all different, because you have these emerging companies, they seem like they're open, but really it's because they're disorganized, and as soon as they get organized, they end up oppressing speech just as much as Susan. You were describing to your own audience that you're essentially using code words. I know what it is because I've been on a monetized channel on YouTube for years. It's amazing, just the amount of cognitive oppression there. That's why I switched to Odyssey.
Do you want to know some like cool lingo, JF?
That we use? Tell me all your code words. I want to understand your videos.
Right, mid-century Germans. You got that right. The mid-century Germans.
Nazis.
Mustache man.
Well, that confuses me, see, because you tell me mid-century Germans, and I think 1950, and I think there were no Nazis in 1950.
You know, we talk about a certain group. Who else do we talk about? You know, I'm trying to remember some of the other.
But I've heard from you the people who control the media. Did you say these words? Or I think I heard that.
The people who control the media, yeah. I mean, the thing is that I actually think, you see, I have a slightly different view to a lot of people on this, where I actually think the purges have helped us. Not like me and you personally, for example, but I think it's helped the discourse. Like, if I think back to the way things were back in like 2016, you know, Frogland, everything was just like SJW dunking videos, and basically what's happened is that as this wave after wave after wave of purges, like in the end, you're left with like you, Keith Woods, me, you know. And basically, I like my theory as to why it's you're basically just left with people who are just like intellectuals rather than entertainers, if that makes any sense.
Because you think censorship helps us, the intellectual within the right wing, to combat our own parasites?
I think in a strange way they have helped the discourse elevate itself from like being the, you know, the kind of a den of scum and villainy it was like back in 2016. It's almost like forced everybody to be more intelligent about the way they make their points. And I actually think, like, how can I put it? Like, basically everybody, whether they've been banned or not, I think people make better stuff now than they did five years ago. Everybody across the board.
Yeah, it's true. 5 years ago, it was easy to clown and to attract viewers. Now that we don't attract, now that the only viewers that will get to us are those who absolutely want to listen to us and are willing to type the URL manually in the browser, that changes the game.
I will say though, right? I can't remember exactly when it was, maybe like 2018, 2017 even. Some of my favorite moments of all time on YouTube were back on when you were on Warski, right?
Oh yeah.
And I have a dark sense of humor, JF, right? But there's two things that stand out to me and I have to mention them. Okay. One was when you had this guy on who was like a genuine cuck. Like, he was a genuine cuckold. Do you remember that?
My God, who was that? Do you know?
He had like a little alien avatar, and there was some, like, I can't remember the drama.
Oh yeah. Oh, that was this. This guy. I stumped him. Oh my God.
And the other one was. There was this moment when Warski went like, I don't know. Like he went a bit nuts, and he started arguing with you and stuff, and you had a little tear roll down your cheek and you were like, Andy, I'm proud of you. You've just become a man. this to me was like maybe you two peaked then that moment.
Oh yeah, something peaked back then. Do you describe the attitude of the current regime as a no dialogue strategy against us? Is that the statement in your last video?
No. So what I was saying in my last video was that our strategy should be no dialogue with them. Okay. And what I was trying to explain was there's this concept that the Marxists have. They took it from Hegel, known as dialectics. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
And there's a strange way in which dialectics make the left stronger. Okay, so I don't know, let's say the left want to do some crazy thing. Okay, they want to make 10-year-old boys into trannies, say. Okay. Mm-hmm. now the right, all through, you know, for most of the time there's been a left and a right, the right have just reacted to that. Okay, to whatever crazy thing it is that the left want. And through that reaction, in a strange way, how can I say, it fuels them. And mm-hmm. they create a kind of vortex whereby over time, the concept that they want becomes normalized. And your enemy starts to turn into you, right? So how can I put it? Like, so if you're constantly arguing with the left, trying to like defeat their points, trying to use their logic, you know, calling them hypocrites, all the usual stuff that people do. Eventually what happens is that somehow you internalize their way of thinking and you end up. So if you have a look at the establishment right over time, they constantly do this, right? So, and in the end, they end up becoming a mirror version. And you can actually see it in UK politics, right, where the two parties start to like merge into each other, like literally, like Labour became Tony Blair, and then the Tories became like David Cameron, who was Tony Blair again, you know. So there's a weird relationship where you start to turn into each other, and you know, I'm still friends with Sargon now, and like he's got this whole strategy where he wants to like read critical race theory and use it back on them type thing. And I'm like, you can see what's happening though, because you end up almost like becoming a version of, you end up thinking in the way that they do. I even see this in strange areas. Like, I mean, we mentioned Eric Stryker, right? just now.
We
mentioned Eric Stryker just now, yeah, right? So take those guys. Like, they have got to a point where I'm listening to them talk and I'm like, this is literally like, I could take what they're saying word for word, and it's like a Jesse Jackson speech from 1970, right? Mm-hmm. Only they're doing it for white people, not for black people, right? Even down to like talk individual talking points about corporate welfare and all of this sort of thing. And I'm like, well.
But I've been an advocate of this, but I understood the limits of it. First, when you say Sargon wants to do this, it's amazing that Sargon doesn't realize that precisely the reversal of CRT is white identity politics, and that this is what we've been doing in 2017. And he wasn't in this. He was complaining against it. So it's quite amazing that he would say today that he wants to do it when he missed the train on it. That being said, I think you're absolutely right. You have to understand the limits of these arguments. These arguments are just to create some cognitive dissonance in the leftists to show, hey, you guys say you're against discrimination, but you're for discriminating white people, right? And it can attract some people toward your cause, people who are logical and rational and who don't like to maintain that kind of cognitive dissonance inside.
Yeah, but I see, what I'm advocating now is that we don't react to them at all.
Yeah.
We just talk to ourselves. We still put our messages out there, right? But we force them to react to us, okay? Because then the system, the regime, you know, idiots like Vaush, whoever the leftists are today, right? they then are in our dialectic. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
They then have to engage with questions like, well, is porn bad? You know, what's all this thing about people like the far right don't want to masturbate I don't know, whatever it happens to, whatever the talking point happens
the
to
no
be, you know, who controls the media, whatever the talking point or the frame is, or at the moment it's stuff about COVID and vaccines or whatever the issue of the day is. If they are reacting to you, they're fact-checking you, they're going off your talking points, you're winning. Like Trump, for all his faults, for all the things that Trump did wrong, he did this. They were always reacting to Trump. Trump was not reacting to them. And whenever they were reacting to Trump, he was controlling the narrative. They were stuck in his dialectic. And mm-hmm. actually the Overton window shifted towards like things that he wanted to focus on, right?
So, very interesting. I never thought of this, but in a way, I think I'm doing this indirectly. A couple of days ago, I started an encyclopedia called arguably.io. There's still no logo, and it's all being set up right now. But that's an example of a text I've written. Biological sex is not binary. And I take the left's argument, and I want to create essentially a right-wing encyclopedia of all bad arguments on the left and good arguments on the right against them. And yeah, in a way, I'm bunkering myself into a corner of the internet. And in a way, this is more of an intellectual pursuit that eventually they will have to debunk. Come to me and treat my argument as something worth debunking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think the more they push people off, you know, like mainstream platforms or whatever, the more it will... We will expose the fact that they actually, for their whole narratives to work, they kind of need us as bad men, as like the boogeyman, you know. So you'll find more and more that they'll actually start like seeking us out in different ways, but they've got no excuse to be there, right? They've got no like, what are you doing in Telegram or in Gab or in like, why have you come over to Odyssey, you know? And I even started seeing this happen on Twitter where, you know, the Twitter spaces that people do, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, oh, I've seen people, this is like, so bizarre. Even when I was on Twitter, and by the way, that's something we didn't mention. We both got banned on Twitter, but when I was on Twitter, I wasn't participating to these Twitter spaces.
You know, I got banned in the most boomerish way, JF. Years ago, I was arguing with some communist, you know, back in 2016 or something. And I said to him, I'm going to hunt you down and eat your liver with a spoon. That was what I said. And I got banned for like making a physical threat or whatever. I was meant to be quoting Robin Hood, you know, or it was like a combination of Hannibal from Silence of the Lambs and Robin Hood.
Okay.
But anyway, they didn't understand the context and I got banned for that. And then any account I've had since, I get banned for like ban evasion because of that one tweet. Well, anyway, I'd had this other account for many years, the one that got banned. But I wanted to play Slay the Spire on my old iPad. And I logged in on that old iPad forgetting. And then it was like, oh, shit.
The eye, you were calling it on YouTube, the eye of Susan, but now you got the eye of Arag Pagrawal.
Pagrawal.
He detected
Pagrawal's alarm went up. And, on the Twitter spaces, right? I think Keith Woods has been banned as well, as yes. has various other people. But
Dr. Malone, Marjorie Taylor Greene. It was a big week of ban in which we got banned.
Yeah, so Keith started doing like Twitter spaces and Richard Spencer started doing Twitter spaces. But if you go in them, you can like see who's watching. And it was all like blue. Like, what are the blue check marks doing in there? Like, why are they like, what do they care about what people are talking about? You know?
Yeah.
Like, what's their excuse to even be in there? You know,
this made me realize maybe watchers of the public space were leftist blue check marks who were hate watching us.
I think the thing is that things are so the system has become so totalitarian now, and it's so full of these kind of like boring HR types, you know, that anyone who's independently minded, you know, is either like keeping a very low profile, or the people like us. So that the only people actually generating ideas, talking about anything of interest, is in our spaces. Like, I mean, it's literally like TV is a desert. You know,
YouTube is a desert at this point. It's very hard to find a good video on YouTube, and you have to browse to your creators and find their channel.
So I think there's a kind of, I'm not trying to spread white pills or anything here, because I also think that realistically, like, deplatforming works, you know, people who had huge platforms no longer do. I'm thinking of like Molyneux, you know. I mean, there are some people who have been more anti-fragile. Alex Jones, for example, he's got big enough following, like he can't be canceled, basically. But there are other people, for whatever reason, you know, what they had on YouTube, they cannot recreate elsewhere. So, you know, there are pros and cons to it. But I don't know if you know, JF, I actually advocate that I actually don't think we should be trying to reach normies anymore.
I think it's a good point. I think that there's nothing to be gained here, and the normies are they feel like a different species to me.
Yeah, but I mean, also, like, you know, it's 2022 now. Who living through the past 5 years could still be a normie, right? Like, do you even want that person? Do you even want that person in your like, because there's a problem. And you saw this with Trump, okay? Every wave of normie who comes in dilutes the movement, if you want to put it that way. They dilute our idea space. They make it more gay and liberal. I'm thinking of, like, I don't know, do you remember when, like, Steve Bannon had, like, Brandon Starker and the Walk Away movement?
Oh, my God. You
know? I mean, this was just like a gay barber, you know? Like, he had the views of a gay man from New York and nothing else. You know, it was just that he didn't like this little bit of political correctness. Or, like, I think that one of the mistakes the mainstream right has done for many years is they just accept, like, they're so desperate for approval they accept any old cast off. You know, it's like, oh, Caitlyn Jenner, like, oh, fuck it, we'll make Caitlyn Jenner our pinup in California now. This is our great Republican hopeful. You know, gays for Trump, blacks for Trump, mm-hmm. all this sort of thing. And it's like, well, it's showing that you're. It's kind of the philosophy of a losing side. It's like, well, we'll just take anyone. I think we need to select for quality. I've got a concept I call the network of tens, where we want to try to cultivate high quality people in our side of things, not just like thinkers and researchers like you and I, JF, but over time we need more like organizers, people who have like other sorts of skills, people who have business skills, just high quality people. Because in the long run, the only, I've been writing this course called Foundations of Politics for quite a long time now. And, reading through many different political theorists over the decades and centuries, the truth is that the populist idea was always a delusion, right? That this idea that today is Martin Luther King Day, is that right? Yeah,
I don't know. I wouldn't know. I've seen some MLK on the chat, but I don't know if that means it's true.
But well, okay. The idea of Martin Luther King in people's minds, okay. People were up in arms in the 1960s because there was inequality and racism. And spontaneously, they took to the streets in protest. In hundreds of thousands of people went to Washington, and Bob Dylan played the guitar there, and Martin Luther King gave a "I Have a Dream" speech, and lo and behold, civil rights was born. Right? I mean, this is a nice story, but it's not how actual change functions. You know, Martin Luther King was the beneficiary of massive donors and vested interests, you know, a certain group behind that and various other funds like Rockefeller Foundation and so on and so forth. The civil rights movement was tightly organized by a set of elites. It was astroturfed. I mean, it's like Greta Thunberg's all the way down. Every popular movement of that kind is basically like, it has the structure of Greta Thunberg, who is not an organic thing, right? She's been put there by vested interests.
They do this for essentially seeding progressivism because it's in their interest, deluded?
No. These vested interests, every single play is a play for power, to take power away from one group and give it to another group. Mm. So like civil rights, what was it? You know, it was, I mean, in the case of civil rights, it was literally, we're going to take stuff from white guys and give it to black guys mm-hmm. and other groups.
Business liberty also.
And at the same time, at the very top, you know, a massive transfer of power and resources from WASPs to Jews. I can say mm-hmm. that, honestly, right?
Yeah,
I
mean, it's totally fine. The Jews, by the way. We love the Jews, yeah, and, but there was a transfer of power.
Yeah, I mean, they essentially became a new elite, plus, various other vestiges of what they call the, rich Irish Catholics like the Kennedys and Italian Catholics like Nancy Pelosi and so on. Mm-hmm. This was a kind of alliance of disgruntled minority groups that had come over in waves of migration in the past, who didn't like WASP culture and its morality and so on and so forth, and basically wanted to use something like civil rights as a battering ram to destroy the old culture and to build a new one. And this is the world we live in.
Absolutely. And we live in this nightmare. As a reminder to our crowd, you can send super chats either through the support option on Odyssey or join the Entropy link. It's right below the video. We already have lots of super chat. Jeffrey Epstein says, JF, where on is... Where is the Neuro TV? How is Neuro TV going? Well, I'm sorry, Jeffrey, but you're dead. And Neuro TV was just a scam to get your money into my pockets. And I got 25,000 from you. I'm pretty happy about it. Total Grimm says, thoughts on the large amount of leftists that are now protesting against COVID tyranny. Are they still leftists? Yeah, that's a good question, academic agent. And what's your position generally on the whole COVID scare, the moral panic, the vaccine maniacal developments in society?
One thing I'll say is that since I'm not a biologist like you, JF, I tuned out pretty early from tracking the data and, you know, talking about the medical side of it. I just found it an endless cavalcade of people just posting graphs at each other. And I tuned, like, it was just like, there's no point in playing that game. My view has been, and I know it's unpopular with a lot of people, that the pandemic was chiefly about consolidating power for current elites, globalists, and destroying the momentum of populism around the world with a set of tangible goals. Mm-hmm. Like removing Donald Trump was one of them.
Yeah,
you know, do you remember in 2019 the economy was in pretty good shape. It was a no-brainer Trump would win again. You know, it destroyed all of that overnight, pretty much.
They destroyed the economy. They self-destroyed for the purpose of destroying Trump with them.
In this country, Boris Johnson's a massive disappointment and a cuck for many different reasons. But don't forget, he came in, he played the populist in his, you know, in his rhetoric and, you know, to get himself elected. Basically, his agenda went out the window overnight. Right. Do you remember he had an 80 seat majority in British, the way the British system works? That basically means that he can do what he wants, pretty much. Like, he has unlimited power. There's nothing stopping him. There's no there is a Supreme Court, but they can't intervene like they can in US politics.
Yeah.
There's like absolutely nothing anybody could do. He could rip up every last bit of like Tony Blair legislation if he wanted to. I mean, the Tories don't want to. But I remember like Dominic Cummings had an agenda to like take an axe to the civil service. And they had all these grand plans all out of the window overnight when COVID became. In Italy, if you remember Salvini, I mean, he, as far as I can see, he's been neutered by this because, you know, he wanted to talk about immigration. Now all anybody talks about is pandemic, you know. Kurz in Austria has been destroyed, right? I mean, he's out now. But at one point, he was a populist great hopeful. Abe in Japan, gone.
Amazing because across the world, not a single amount of resistance, except perhaps Sweden. Sweden kind of kept its cool. But you could have had a Trump say to the experts, to the medical fascist, fuck off with your request. People are going to die from the coup as they do every year. Fuck off. We keep business up.
Well, one thing I remember, though, I remember seeing, like, before the pandemic, a chart. You know, they do those charts of, like, you know, nobody trusts politicians anymore. Nobody trusts journalists anymore. You know, and if you remember, there was a whole narrative around the time of Brexit and around the time of Trump that people don't trust experts anymore, that people didn't trust economists anymore because they, you know, because of the sheer amount of lies they told, essentially. But the one group that did have quite high public trust still was doctors.
Yeah.
And I find it very interesting that it just so happens that it was a health, you know, that the angle was health. And it was one of those things where, you know, you could feasibly show the hand of the managerial state, you know, and nobody would object too much because everybody knows that all of the politicians aren't doctors, right? So they have to take the back seat in this scenario.
That's fascinating. So you think that the people who control this world saw a margin of action in the fact that people before the pandemic highly trusted doctors, and they said, yes, we're going to go through the doctors.
Yeah. I believe, I mean, it's just too much of a coincidence otherwise, right? And you know, these people are obsessed with poll data. They're obsessed with nudge units. And this is the way, you know, that the whole regime that we live under is a regime of perception management, right? They want to control the, I got this book here by Walter Lippmann called the Phantom Public. You know, he's got this idea that the public doesn't really exist, and whatever ideas people have in their minds, he calls a pseudo reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how the media can create a pseudo reality. Well, I mean, what is the, like, if the media did not exist, would anybody know there was a pandemic? For the first, 9 months, year or so, I comply with everything. I wore a mask and all that sort of stuff because partly I live in an area where you'll get a lot of people like touching and looking at you and stuff. So it's kind of like a pretty high compliance area.
Oh yeah.
But since they've tried to go back, I've stopped complying with anything, you know. And I've been asked a few times, you know, you're going to put a mask, and usually I'll say, no, I'll go and wait. I'll go and stand outside or whatever. But one time I just responded to this person in the supermarket. And I said, look, listen, I did a test this morning. I tested negative. I don't have COVID. And they were like, yeah, it doesn't matter. What are the other customers going to think? So yeah. It's like even the nominal idea of wearing the mask is just, what do they call it? Like a kind of governance theater, right?
It's to protect yourself from social perceptions rather than a virus.
Exactly. But what it did do is it demonstrated that when push comes to shove, they still have, like, how can I put it? If you think about politics in terms of friend and enemy, it was actually very useful for current ruling elites they can now pinpoint who are the people who comply and who are the people who do not.
Mm-hmm.
And with the vaccine, it actually marks, it actually says, well, this person is, they're now unvaccinated. They're an enemy of the regime.
Yeah.
They are immune to our PSYOP. You know, they're not going to play ball, these people. And you've already started seeing, like I saw Macron a couple of weeks ago, was starting to speak in these terms, like the unvaccinated, like he's trying to unperson the unvaccinated. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I think in Europe in general, they started to, like in a couple of weeks in the UK, anyone who's unvaccinated who works for the NHS is going to be fired.
Justin Trudeau saying the unvaxxed are misogynist and racist very often.
relationship. This just so happens to be a way. Like, you can't quantify, well, how many people are racist? How many people are white nationalists? You can't quantify any of those things, but you can quantify who has and has not had the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also a very, very neat mechanism for them to be able to pinpoint exactly who the troublemakers are in this increasingly like totalitarian way they want to go down. Like, I mean, I would say that I think liberal democracy and the system that we've lived under has always been, quote, totalitarian in this way, right? It's just that the pandemic has made it like very, very clear. It's also exposed as well the extent to which the economy is basically like centrally planned and managed, like top down. I remember it was like overnight the supermarkets like transformed. They had all those like footsteps and they had the mask signs up, and it was just like overnight. You know, they less than 24 hours. And, you know, basically a command economy. We're in a command economy. I mean, BlackRock. I mean, we've got absurd scenarios now, like BlackRock selling EFTs to the Fed, who buy them. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, BlackRock, I think, own half the EFTs in the world or something.
Mm-hmm.
And now they can basically use the Fed to direct exactly where they want things to go. And you're starting to see like almost Soviet things on the shelves. Unfortunately, my daughter was ill today, so I had to cancel my usual show, Deepest Lore, that I do on Monday afternoons. But we were gonna talk about earlier on this thing Beyond Meat. Have you seen this thing?
Oh yeah, I've seen it. Mama JF goes crazy when she sees these fake meats. She's very scared of them.
Yeah, fake meat, right? Now every supermarket you go to, every restaurant, McDonald's, you know, every chain has now brought out their Beyond Meat burger. You go into the supermarket, 8 p.m., 9 p.m., nobody's bought a single one. They're all reduced down to, you know, down to almost zero. You know, but they're really pushing this. Like, if you go to McDonald's and you know, they've got that electronic menu. If you push that menu, you'll see that they're not just promoting this Beyond Meat burger. They've put it like number one. It's the first thing that you see. So, I mean, these are like, you know, these are persuasion techniques to try to push you to do, you know, to make a certain decision. Now I know that you know a bit about the old free market economics, JF, just like me. We both came from like a libertarian background, right?
Mm-hmm.
The economy is not meant to work like that. It's meant to be bottom up, but we can see that actually, just like everything else, it's basically top down. You know, it's basically like consumers are not driving what is on the shelves.
Yeah.
Consumers are not. And we see this.
Mama
more
JF has an opinion on the burgers.
Yes, hello. I'm so scared of this because we watched a video about this, and there was a woman and she made some research about the Beyond Meat, and she said that she looked on Google Map and she said the main factory was right next to Planned Parenthood.
So she thinks that there are ground up babies, ground up embryos, human embryos in there.
Well, you can see that they are absolutely pushing this heavily. And if you ever look under the hood, you know, we've been tracking. I had Faust on a couple of weeks ago, and they are like, you know, that the Dutch government are paying farmers to get out of farming.
Mm-hmm.
They want to stop. They want to stop farmers producing beef because of farting cows.
Yeah.
But this is happening in every country. You know, Bill Gates buying up half the farmland in America and in India and in Sri Lanka. What do they want with all this land? You know, and it just strikes me that at the same time all of this is happening, they're pushing this Beyond Meat thing. I sense something sinister is going on.
There is an attack on nature in general, and I think it's part of our nature to be farmers. And it's still, as of today, through the whole changes of society, remaining a farmer has essentially protected a bunch of European peoples and Canadians and Americans from the toxicity of the modern world. I mean, you go into a farmer family, you look at their children, they're healthy, they eat healthy, they are independent, they don't depend on anyone, anything, and they are often not brainwashed by the regime.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm one of the, I mentioned that course I was writing, The Foundations of Politics. One of the thinkers that I'm covering on there is called Bertrand de Jouvenel. Yes, it's probably not.
Yeah, I've been looking. You have an academic agency, and so your next course will be Foundation of Politics, but you already have a lot of courses on there.
Politics,
and in fact,
yeah.
You've just announced a Foundation of Physics that will be given by someone else than you who knows physics.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you could do the biology one, JF. Why not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been asked to do a biology course, so maybe one day I would dream of having the time to do it.
It is pretty time consuming.
It is. That's what I told the audience member. I said, it would be years essentially preparing this.
But anyway, this thing about Bertrand de Juvenal, he sees like the main mechanism of political change through history is this alliance of the high and the low against the middle. Okay, so it is always in the interests of the current power center, the current ruling elite, to ally with these client groups or periphery groups against essentially feudal castles that are resistant to your power, that are an alternative power source. So with the Dutch government attacking these farmers, or with globalists attacking the farmers, you can see it as them trying to take out a rival castle, if you want to put it that way. And just the same, like with all these like spiteful mutant groups that we see, you know.
Oh no, not the spiteful mutants. Don't get me started on this theory, this ridiculous term. But anyways, I understand what you mean.
Oh, sorry. You know what I'm saying? Like the like the, you know, the BLM and so on and so forth. These are all like periphery client groups that the regime uses to attack essentially post-bourgeois, white, chiefly independent groups who are resistant to their power. What's quite scary about this in a way is the fact that they're basically out of institutions to take over now. Like there isn't a church, there isn't like a, you know, like if you've got a town and it's got like a little local like history museum, you know, it's already been paused and taken over by some like disgusting leftist. You know, there's almost nowhere that hasn't been taken over. So literally they're pretty much out of castles to take over. So they've moved on basically to like direct attacks on the population, you know, like direct attacks on farmers, small businessmen, people like me and you. I don't know, like, how can I say? Like, it looks bleak from our point of view, right? Very bleak.
It's amazing how efficient they've been at conquering essentially society within less than 100 years.
But I still think there's reason to have some hope that there could be in this their own downfall, if that makes any sense, because the people who they are currently excluding are people of ability, talent, and creativity. Okay, the independent thinker. We are basically like kulaks, right? Yeah. They're attacking the kulaks at the moment. But these are your productive people in society.
Oh yeah, and the whole rest of society, 95% are just draining energy.
Now, let's just take me and you, okay? In a normal time, I'd be sitting in an ivory tower somewhere in a university, in a, you know, not bothering anyone, just writing books on literature or something. And you'd be the same, right? You'd be the same. You'd just be a polite researcher doing nothing, not bothering anyone.
Yeah.
You know, they fire me, they fire you. Or they make
they
sure
just
that
don't employ us.
Yeah, we are out of the system, you know. Okay. Yeah. So, but that means that we're not like old men. We have our entire lives ahead of us. And we're driven, right? So we're not going to, like, we are a bit like, okay, you've made a lifelong enemy of me and you now. You could have used our talents. Now we use our talents against you, okay? Now you have to imagine the multiplier effect, okay? Who are all the young men in our audience? Like, there are guys in my audience who've already been like doxxed and stuff. They're like 24, mm-hmm. you know, talented guys.
They're 24 and they have nothing to lose. And they're like a terrorist on the path of destroying society.
So, I mean, what I'm saying is that when you get to the level where you're basically alienating would-be elites for you, okay, now you are creating what becomes a counter-elite, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. I mean, this is how I was thinking in 2017 when I was seeing us rise on YouTube as kind of parallel intellectuals, anti-e-celebs of some kinds. I was thinking this is what we're establishing. We're establishing a counterweight to a forming power, and it's so much truer, so much better that it can only win.
Yeah. So, in time, as more and more trust drains away from them, as they get more and more absurd, as they get as fewer and fewer people buy into the lies that they have to, you know, because it's very like late Soviet Union now, right? The regime, like, where people are asked to say things that are patently absurd on a daily basis, you know, like but Biden has this minister who is like, but who makes no effort to actually look like a woman. Have you seen this person? I forget the name.
I think I remember seeing pictures.
But everybody in the room is expected to maintain the fiction with a straight face that this is a woman, right? this is where we are now, right? I mean, this is the... there was a very good film made a few years back called The Death of Stalin. Did you see that film?
No.
Where... it was basically just showing like how like people in like Soviet society, like the rulers of Soviet, had to like daily change their lies, and they had to like quickly like double think themselves into some new fiction, you know, otherwise they might get shot or something, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is kind of where we are now. So that's one thing. The other thing is that it's something that Morgoth has talked about, which is that he takes this passage from Sun Tzu, where Sun Tzu said you always have to give your like enemy somewhere to escape, somewhere to run away to. Otherwise, they'll fight to the last man. And I feel like the regime has become more and more like insane in a way. Like they're very insistent that they're going to declare war on like 30% of the whole population. Like, if you listen to the way the Biden administration speaks, it's fucking mental. The language that they use.
That Biden is an old man, he's known a world in which he didn't have to say these words.
Yeah, but I mean, practically speaking, can you alienate and try to like unperson 30% of your total population when they're the 30% who are also like these productive, like, is this possible? Has any regime in history managed to have a ruling class that is not overthrown, that basically declares war on, you know, that 30% of the population?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're basically declaring war on the middle class. You know,
yeah.
This is who we're talking about, and some of the working class as well. I mean, I just don't think. Like, how long can that sustain itself? That's my question. I mean,
I don't think it can. The other guy. Well, I have to cough 1 minute. All right. The other guy sends a $25 super chat. He says, hey, I've been a fan since 2015, started listening to alt-right TRS content and drifted away. It's so great to see your opinions grow and change. What was the tipping point? I stopped paying attention until Millennial this year. You were my favorite along with Enoch and the Distributist. Sorry, JF. Well, no, it's okay that you have your preferences. So, yeah, Academic Agent, the current view that you lay out today, has this been your view since a long time?
I think a very pivotal turning point for me was in 2018 when I read a book called The Machiavellians by James Burnham. I don't know if you've read this book, but it introduced me to a set of thinkers called the elite theorists. Gaetano Mosca, Vilfredo Pareto, who you probably know as an economist.
No.
Robert Michels, who's got the iron law of oligarchy.
Oh, well, Pareto from the Pareto principle.
Exactly, Pareto. Okay. But this Pareto, as well as being like a world famous economist, also like invented modern sociology, essentially. And he wrote this massive book called The Mindless Society, where he laid out his theory of the circulation of elites. This basically changed the way I view power and politics and the way things work in many different ways. And it kind of divested me of a lot of liberal fictions and also support for democracy or belief in democracy as a way of, as a viable system, if you want to put it that way. Like, mm-hmm. these guys don't just say that democracy is undesirable, like Hopper, right? They say it's impossible. Like, democracy is impossible. Like, all power is oligarchy, basically, in one way or the other. It always functions in the same way. But what democracy does that all the other systems don't do is it obscures the transparency of power. Mm-hmm. It basically creates a smokescreen, an illusion. It sells the public a fiction that they are sovereign. The public
It dilutes the oligarchical violence and hides it under a booth and hides it under the anonymity of voting.
Yeah, absolutely. Just the idea that somebody else can represent your interests rather than just their own. Mm-hmm. Should be an absurdity on the face of it. They've got a lot of interesting phrases like, you know, nobody gets elected. They get themselves elected by their friends, essentially, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, the other thing that democracy does is it grants tremendous power to the media. And therefore it grants tremendous power to anybody powerful enough to own media organizations. Right.
Very interesting. So the First Amendment would be kind of an entry point for the power of media as a legitimate part of the oligarchy of democratic societies.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, Edward Bernays, who you've probably heard of, in his book on propaganda, Edward Bernays was a nephew of Freud, who wrote in the 1920s and 30s. He was like basically invented modern PR. That's what his kind of claim to fame is. But he's got like loads of really dark essays like Engineering Consent and various other things where he talked openly about the need to like reprogram the public to, you know, think what he wants them to think. And he says basically like in his defense of democracy, he said like the First Amendment is basically the right to be propagandized to. It is the right to be propagandized to. This is the freedom, you know. So it was kind of like, I would say reading that book and getting me on that path of reading the Machiavellians was a massive turning point in my thinking. And then basically seeing everything I was reading play out in the real world, you know, like the 2020 election, basically like, it's one thing to know all these things in theory. It's another thing to like live through it and see it blatantly in front of your eyes, mm-hmm. right? And I think that the combination of those two things is kind of what has changed my thinking more than anything else. Now I've never really turned my back on the Austrian economics or any of that. I will say though that since the pandemic has started and since they've done like money printing on a scale that I thought was previously impossible, anything I thought about economics is kind of like, we're off the map now. I just don't even know what's happening anymore. And I think that like a lot of the overturning of the liberal fictions that I've been working on for the past few years have been to demolish the bottom-up view of the world, right? I know this is very popular in liberalism, that they think that everything is like biology, everything's like evolution, everything is a bottom-up, you know, gradual process. Whereas actually, most things, politics, culture, social change, organization of any sort is top down. Okay. Law is top down.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I found a study the other day that showed that they did this study on across like 1,700 US policies over like, I don't know, like a 20-year period. It was like a Harvard or Yale study versus public opinion. And they found a near zero correlation between public opinion and the actual laws that were passed by Congress. A mm-hmm. near zero correlation. So that just shows you how unresponsive the system is to like what people actually think. You know, like your mind will automatically go to like immigration or something, but it's anything. It's like literally the lawmakers do not care what the plebeian thinks in any respect.
Unresponsive is what describes my experience of the entire world at this point. You know, the elites are unresponsive. The e-celebs at this point are not even responsive. And this is where I'm not so sad about being kicked from Twitter. It's that I wasn't getting responses. Like, they don't care. You can prove them wrong in a tweet or make an argument. They'll just engage with you if it's in their interest, and it's not in their interest.
Exactly, yeah. It's just like raw power at this point.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say is that the one element of my thinking that I have not reconciled is the economic side of it, where economics is still this kind of like, you know, consumer driven, like the consumer is sovereign and the consumer is meant to, you know, impute value up through the chain. You know, and the prices float upwards, like in the classical, like Austrian.
This is something you know, you still accept.
I think it's obvious that our current economy does not work in any respect in that way. For example, you know, I went to a supermarket the other day. And just took some pictures of some shelves, of random shelves, like chocolate bar shelves, you know, crisps. I think in Canada you may call them potato chips, right? And I just went through like several different categories of products. And basically in any given market, you essentially have a dominant brand. Like there's a Coca-Cola, which is about 70% market share in beverages, okay? Or in the UK, in chocolate, it's Cadbury's, 70% of chocolate. Man, you know, chocolate sales is all Cadbury's. And then there'll be a number two, there'll be a Pepsi, there'll be a number two brand, which will have like, I don't know, like 25%. And then you've got like supermarket owned and that's it. In most product lines, in like cosmetics, for example, Procter & Gamble and Unilever basically make like, in some categories, Procter & Gamble don't just own the top brand, they own like the next two brands down as well. So what that process kind of shows you is that our supermarket shelves are like they're like a kind of simulation of 1950s capitalism or 1930s mm-hmm. capitalism. Like the brands are like frozen back in that time. Even though they've all been taken over through corporate mergers or purchases or whatever, since that time, you know, you're still given the illusion that there is something like a market taking place. Whereas in actuality, I actually just don't believe that any of them would actually respond to supply and demand in any single way. Let's pretend that me and you did an experiment. And we went out and we bought like every single, you know, those like Reese's peanut butter cups, right? You know, those.
Mama Jeff loves those.
Yeah. Right. Let's pretend that me and you did an experiment and we went out in a, I don't know, like a 5-mile radius And for a space of like 3 months, me and you just bought every single Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the stock manager of those stores would actually respond to the increased demand for Reese's? Like, do you think like in the next month they'd stock more Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, or do you think they would completely just
experiment and they don't fix it, because there are these stores where I would go and I would empty the shelves of some item. And it wouldn't be refilled before months, and I would re-empty it, and it wouldn't be refilled for months still.
So there you go. Like, supply and demand, it just doesn't operate, because we don't have a real free economy. We have a simulation of a free economy. Mm-hmm. It's something like Oscar Lange's kind of like. Well, I can't remember what they called it. You know, like in Yugoslavia, they had like market socialism. Mm-hmm. This is something like our economy now. It's market. It's kind of corporate market socialism, I think.
I agree, and that's quite shocking to say. IGN says, does Academic Agent think libertarians are an enemy to his movement or the right in general?
I did a series of videos on... I think it was a while back, but it was like a series of four or five videos called "Why Libertarians Are Not Like Are Not Good Enemies to Socialism" or something like this, or "Why Libertarians Are the Handmaidens to Socialism." And I think the issue is that they share a lot of the same principles, like the ultimate end goal of the libertarian is unlimited like freedom for the individual, right? But this is also the ultimate end goal of the Marxist. Like the socialist, like the communist utopia is also a stateless world where the individual is free to like be anything they want to be, you know, free of impediment from the state or anything else. And on top of that, they're ultimately materialist doctrines. So I've come to see them as kind of like two sides of the same, coin, if you want. They just disagree on how they want to get there, you know? So that's one thing. The other thing is that in more like practical, political history, libertarianism basically like hamstrung, shackled the right after 1945. I mentioned that Substack. Most of the posts I've made there are paid, but the very first one is a free post that I've made just for as a kind of little taster, if you want. And in there, I talk about like William F. Buckley and the kind of alliance between the libertarians and the and the kind of neocons, you know, the Cold War hawks after 1945. And I think libertarianism is just like filling a hole. It was like, it was put in the slot of being on the right just to like give people something to do, like a fake opposition, if you want. Whereas what you might call the real right, who are people who, I mean, are called fascist, right? But it's just anybody who wants to defend tradition, who wants to defend their people, who wants to defend their homeland, who wants to defend their cultural heritage, who doesn't want, libertinism, all of these sorts of things. That was basically outlawed after 1945. So libertarianism was kind of the system's way of just like giving the opposition to the left something to do, essentially. But also they helped to dissolve tradition as well, libertarians. If you have a look at like, you know, the history of law changes, libertarians are always like pushing, and they managed to get conservative laws abolished. But then the left come along and they put some new leftist law in their place, and they never abolished that. So if you want like the it's like a two-step process. The libertarians demolish the tradition and the old law. The leftists come along and institute some new thing. You know,
I don't disagree with much here. I think that you're right that the modern libertarians are not efficacious. They are essentially walking hand in hand with the left, especially when you hear the leftist libertarian or those who identify as such. And it does go hand in hand with the delusion of Marxism that we will free the people. We will free the people through a socialist state that will lead to eventually a communist state or a communist stateless society. That being said, my definition of libertarianism is a little bit larger. And to me, an American 150 years ago was pretty much a libertarian. Because to me, libertarianism is about boiling it down to personal choice, because no other structure is better to handle the decisions that will lead to consequences. And so the individual becomes the best unit to make the decision, since he's going to pay the price of that decision.
Unfortunately, I have come to disagree with this. This may be true of you, JF, and it may be true of me, but I believe that there is such a thing. And I mean, you're the biology guy, so feel free to shoot this down. But I have actually come to believe that there is such a thing as a natural peasant, right? As a natural minion, as a natural NPC. And I actually think that most people ever in history actually prefer being told what to do and having a master.
But that's in no contradiction with my version of libertarianism, because I say the peasant should be the one choosing to what he is the peasant to who he is the peasant of.
Right, so you're kind of more like free market feudalism, way.
Free market feudalism.
You get to choose your own, like, feudal lord or something.
The other guy. Did I read this super chat? No. He says, lastly, Academic Agent, do you listen to Fash the Nation? Their deep dives on Trump's backers, QAnon, and government involvement in January 6th are second to none. Truly the deepest of dives.
I have to check those out. I'd have to check those out. I have.
It's quite a phenomenon, no? These QAnon MAGA boomers, they've kind of disappeared of the internet, but what a bizarre bunch.
Yeah, I'm actually fascinated by the fact that I go on, if ever I don't go on BitChute as much as I used to, because the UK basically banned all of the channels that I could watch. Like, I just get this notice now saying the UK government don't think is appropriate for you to be watching this. Yeah. whenever I go on to BitChute, all those kind of QAnon people are still there, like trending every day. Like, what are they called? X22 report and like Charlie Ward and all these sort of people. I'm like, I thought you guys said Trump was still the president. You know, I don't know where they quietly dropped that. I actually had a funny like month of the, you know, like the month between the election finishing and January the 6th and the inauguration. A few of us kind of like, because we were kind of in uncharted waters, and like guys like Vox Day had started talking about like, hold on, have a look at this weird thing. And we kind of got into that for like a month. We called it the copium den. And I maintain it was one of the most fun times ever, like in these sorts of spheres, because it was just, you know, crazy shit was happening every single day. And then like Trump would like fire off like random executive orders and it'd be like, hold on a second, why did he change the three generals there? Like, really weird stuff was happening. And it was all like on the table, basically, and I was saying, like, listen, none of us know what's happening here. We're in uncharted waters. So let's just wait until the inauguration and see what happens. Right? When the inauguration happened, fucking nothing happened whatsoever.
Of course.
Trump cucked in all ways. And when they came out and they were like, oh yeah, Biden was a hologram, you wait until March, you know, Trump is really still the president. And I was like, oh, fucking come on now, guys. So it was kind of weird, because up until all of the facts were in, what they were saying was kind of like they could keep it going for a couple of weeks, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's just like, well, now the facts are it, like, Biden's a president. What are you doing? You know, and I just find that kind of fascinating psychologically how those guys still have, you know, tens of thousands of people watching them. Like, I was like, hold on, like, you watch this guy lie to you in your face like 6 months ago and you're still watching him. So I find that I think people like hope more than they like reality, basically. There's a guy on YouTube, I don't know if you've ever seen him, JF, called Steve Turley. You ever seen this guy?
Oh yeah, I've seen him, yeah.
Like he's always like optimistic. We're gonna win, like, all the time. And he has like hundreds and thousands of viewers. I think people like, there's something in human nature that likes positivity and optimism.
Oh yeah, people were super critical of me for being a black pillar when I said in 2020 on the millennial, be ready to see the total crash of the right wing and the total crunching and stomping on by the left wing. The leftists are going to take over society and there's not going to be any live streams anymore with hundreds of views and thousands of viewers. There's not going to be free speech anymore. There's not going to be free business. They're going to crack down on anything right wing. And, you know, people were complaining at me, but I was right, largely. The COVID stuff that happened and the censorship is essentially the full takeover, and on top of it, the Biden presidency. All of it happened as I had predicted.
Yep. Can't argue.
Itinerant sends two super chats on Entropy. Thank you so much. He says, here is something towards your server and more pigs. Maybe you would be interested in Kevin McCarron's work. If you haven't heard of him, he's a neuroscientist who got booted from YouTube for the heinous crime of discussing scientific evidence at McCarronDojo.com. Yeah, I know about the guy, but isn't he the guy who took position for prions, for the vaccine or the COVID-inducing prion disease in the brain? And I think there was no basis for it, but I'm not sure we're talking about the same guy. But yeah, I'll go check his website to make sure I'm talking about the right one. And he says to Academic Agent, what do the two honorable academics think about doing a PhD at a Western institution? Of course, I am taking foundations of politics, but I want to build on it and bought it to formulate a potential research proposal for something bigger on narratives of global governance. Wow, mm-hmm. Academic Agent, is your course online a springboard for a true PhD career?
Well, I mean, you'd have to have the other relevant qualifications, like a master's degree or something. But I would suggest that it's all about, like, you can still find, or at least you could a few years ago, decent academics in the academy. So it's all about finding the right supervisor. They've probably all been fired now, but like you can still find them, right? So it's all about locating someone who you think might be a good supervisor and then being willing to like move there. To be honest, most of a PhD you do on your own, right? So if it's just like you want to have a PhD, go for it. The only thing I would say is that most of the time a PhD is just to get a career in academia. Most of the time, the only reason to do a PhD in any humanity subject, at least, would be with a view to go on to have a career. And the question you'd have to ask yourself is like, can you stand to be surrounded by the paws like 24/7? You know, like be shoved in your face, basically.
Yeah, I'll tell you, a PhD is not worth it from a practical viewpoint, from even a salary viewpoint. The system is not really in need of, tenured professor anymore. And so you're going to be relegated at second grade employment as chargé de cours, as we call it in Quebec, where you give a little course and you're kind of the subordinate of some other professor. On top of it, you're going to have to submit for like 5 years to the system. And PhD is not a place to do original thinking. You're going to have to walk very thinly on the line that was set for you. So if you have a kind of revolutionary type of brain who likes creativity and who likes to create, you're not going to enjoy it. That being said, I did it. I got my PhD. And it was suffering and it was kind of useless. And it, when I think about it, it was a big loss of time. But I'm not unhappy about having done it. So it's all about, do you want to sacrifice 5 years of your mental health and physical wellness and life for something absolutely useless that will end up as a piece of paper that shows some pride in your ability to self-negate to the extent of realizing it? If you like this kind of stuff, go ahead and do your PhD. We also have questions about transhumanism emerging on Odyssey and Entropy. Thought Criminal says, academic agent, what is your opinion of transhumanism? Also, do you think there will ever be a technological singularity?
I don't really have my, I mean, I still have, I noticed that Keith Woods has a new video out where he looks like a kind of Star Trek guy. Like he's like all dressed all in black with a black background.
Yeah, I saw it.
And I haven't watched that video yet, but it's
not so much about transhumanism. I watched the video and I was like, okay, he's talking about elites and he's not talking that much about transhumanism.
I don't really understand what it is, to be honest. I haven't, like, and I know Morgoth's been talking about it.
Well, it's the whole movement of connecting technology to the human body. So chips in the brain, extension of life, you're pumped up on nicotine and caffeine, and you have a mechanical heart beating to keep you alive 200 years. And you can upload your mind to a computer to live in a virtual metaverse.
I don't have much thought on that. I mean, isn't this your whole area, Jeff?
Yes, like, it's the subject of the revolutionary phenotype.
Yeah, I thought so, right? I don't know. I don't know about any of that stuff. I think that one of the strange things, though, is that have you noticed the way that all of these things that once seemed like bright and optimistic ideas now take on like a weirdly dystopian air, even in the way that people like the World Economic Forum, they make these videos, but they've all got this kind of creepy dystopianism in them.
Yeah. And it's surprising that they actually assume that creepiness. Like you would expect them to hide it, but no, it's like you're going to own nothing and be happy. How bad of a marketing strategy is that? Well, maybe it's a good one if the population is filled with sheeps who just want this.
Well, one of the things I did here is that people, I can't remember who said this now, but I hear that people kind of overestimate the extent to which technology and AI and things can, like, they overestimate what it can actually do. Yeah. Is that true, JF?
Well, yeah, I would say yes, because you look at the brain chip thing. The brain chip thing right now is like, if you were to have one, you would have to super concentrate just to tell a computer between 0 and 1. And it would like take you 3 seconds to be like, 0. And you would invest so much cognitive effort. It's like, it's really not efficient. It's still more efficient to communicate with the computer with a keyboard. So yes, people have delusions that it's going to be great. It's going to be great. But the fact is, it's a bunch of metal wires just popped in your brain, and it's literally a pop. I've won because I used to work on monkeys and do brain surgery. I know what it is. It's a gun, and it's like, poo, it shoots the chip in your brain. There's no subtlety to it, and we have no ability to do a subtle connection with specific neurons. It's just a poof of a metal piece, and it detects what it can. So yes, definitely it's true.
I mean, I have a theory that as the powers that be, as globalism becomes more and more virtual and online and metaverse and all this sort of thing, that they actually become quite weak to what I would call the analog world. And I've got this vision of like this kind of dark future where, like, you know, we're all like trading like old VHS tapes to each other and kind of like living, because
cyberpunk.
the Eye of Sauron can't see the non-digital world, right?
Yeah.
So at some point, if we're going to become like true dissidents, like if this online thing is ever going to like become like a real life thing, there will have to be a move to like do stuff that you cannot see, right? And in fact, people who were mentioning Stryker Mike earlier on, they made a point somewhere where they were saying that when Jews meet in real life, they don't like do any of their communication online or in recorded written text. They meet in a bar to do their business, right? Mm-hmm. Even now, because it's not trackable. It's just out in the like, and I think that at some point, as people get more organized, they're going to have to do more of that kind of real world stuff where it's just like, because the Eye of Sauron can't see you just talking in a bar.
Yeah, you know? I've seen it. There are farming groups, gardening groups, normie mothers just meeting who want to resist to the vaccine fascism. I've seen it locally. People are tending to make these meetups and form new local communities. It's quite fascinating. Now we have, I wanted to talk about this and we'll be headed toward the conclusion. Academic Agent was saying on Gab, don't debate left-wing woman. Let them know the reason you're splitting up is for their cringe politics. Do not breed left-wing woman. You are going at your dating life and the dating life of your audience from the perspective of evolution and farming. You say, let us not farm left-wing woman. I think it's a great tip, Academic Agent, but now the next step is, how do we find a right-wing woman?
Well, I mean, I would suggest that... And no offense to any actual women watching. I don't think there's such a thing as a based woman.
Yeah,
like, I've come to the conclusion that like, and also that like even women who come into right wing spaces, I don't know if you notice on my channel, I've got this show called Women's Hour now. Past like
this
20
one, I didn't see. No,
I've got a show called Women's Hour where I basically put all the women in one show. Right.
Okay. Oh yeah, I saw one of those.
Yeah, so
I didn't click on it.
But they just like, I mean, literally, you know, it's a nice little show, but they talk about men, they talk about feelings, and they talk about politics, they talk about like stuff women talk about, right? And in my experience, women, even if they're in these spaces, they're more interested in women stuff. You know, they want to talk about like knitting or fucking like, you know, make anything but politics, basically. They want to talk about like Lindy walks and all of this nonsense. So I think that the best you can hope for is just like a normal woman, right? It's just like the overtly leftist woman,
mm-hmm,
who you want to avoid. Because like, I have not followed my own advice in life, JF.
Oh yeah.
I've dated several like rabid feminists in my time.
Oh, yeah. You and they pay are the all, price. You end up
they
paying
are all
the price.
Insane.
Yeah.
They're all, like it seriously. They are all like, I think there's something in all of their backgrounds that makes them a bit kind of like, there's some like weird thing in their background, and it makes them like oddly, like a bit kinky and a bit, almost like a bit rapey as well. Makes any sense.
Yeah, totally. They are destructive. That's what happens. They are so anti-system, and they will eventually conclude that you're part of the system, and they want to destroy everything around them. That's what leftism is. They see oppression through everything, and eventually, if you marry them or you date them, they will end up finding you are the source of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Academic Agent. Oh, yeah, one last question. Fish Barista was saying, Walter Kruger sent a super chat. He says, you will learn actual fascism is the way. Then you will become sad at what happened 80 years ago. Then you will realize we can never give in to weakness. We must organize and plan for a better future. All right, a fascist fan of the show. Thank you, Walter. Fish Barista says, academic agent, how integral is evolution to your political understanding and projects, and why isn't it more important? Get learning.
Well, funny enough, I actually wrote a book where I applied evolutionary approaches to literature a few years ago. One of my first books, I was very into evolution, and I actually learned about different camps. Like, there was the group evolutionists, and there was the kin selection guys like Dawkins and friends, you know. And then there were like these really bad ones, Stephen Gould and Lee Wooten, who were basically like fucking Marxists, mm-hmm. like species guys.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I think I remember writing, in my kind of survey of all of the different positions, that basically everybody accepts that those guys are like frauds now, right? They've been discredited, even though they were once championed by the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
They were just like political leftists, right? Who were,
yeah.
I'm kind of a fay with, you know, the basics of evolution. However, since I got into more like reactionary literature, I have become more skeptical of seeing evolution as a kind of anchor for your worldview, or your social kind of, because I tend to see, how can I say, I think the notion of entropy or decline has utility for us. And I think if your worldview is wedded to evolution, it's a bit more difficult to have like decline as a core part of your grand meta narrative. So that doesn't mean I disbelieve evolution, or I think there's a danger. And this happened, you know, in the 19th century. Herbert Spencer famously had a sociology like built around evolution and social Darwinism and so on. And I feel like it kind of naturally leads to a kind of progressivism, and I'm wary of progressivism and where it leads. Basically.
All right. What do you think? Very interesting. Academic Agent, you've delivered extremely insightful thoughts tonight. Thank you so much. I've put the link to your Gab, to your Substack, and to the Academic Agency. If you'd like to buy the courses of Academic Agent or subscribe to him on Substack, he's been there for a couple of days already, and there are already four or five articles. Very interesting stuff, Academic Agent. You are a brilliant guy, and I'm so happy to have talked to you again.
Thanks a lot, JF.
All right. I have to do some announcement on a solo part of the show, but thanks so much for coming, and let's talk again in the future.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Oops. We have... Well, there we go. Are you doing, people of the regular chat? Quite amazing to see those big numbers in terms of audience. Very happy to see 550 people watching live. It's great. We're going to keep getting guests as much as we can. We're going to talk to Richard Spencer later this week on the show has been moved. I wanted to do that announcement. The show with Richard Spencer has been moved to Thursday instead of Wednesday. So it will be Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the 20th. It was great to hear Academic Agent. On his last point, I would say, I don't think evolution binds you to a progressive view. I think it's important to understand that what the worsening that Academic Agent talks in the form of entropy, the worsening of the world is also visible through the evolution lens. Evolution is also the phenomenon by which less intelligent people eventually end up dominating the world. Evolution is also the mechanism by which intelligence is not favored because it's genetically disadvantageous, and eventually you end up with only unintelligent people. This is the great black pill of evolution. It's that it's constantly subject to parasitism, and it's important not so much to ask yourself, does it have a view of entropy that fits my narrative around the social world? You have to ask yourself, is it true? If evolution is true, you have to integrate it to your worldview. And it's a wonderful place to start. 270 doctors, some news today that have been that I didn't get a chance to bring in the discussion with Academic Agent, but that I wanted to have a look at. 270 doctors called out Joe Rogan, but the vast majority of authors, signatories, are not medical doctors. Amazingly, I had covered this news item. I didn't know that there were so many PhDs in there that are just like humanities PhD, and it's like, okay, you guys are going to be the reference on which people make decisions. That doesn't make sense. Jordan Peterson schools Ethan Klein on cancel culture after a YouTuber deletes videos. Ethan Klein, you know, in terms of cucking to the system, there's no better model than Ethan Klein. Now, to be clear, I understand having to delete controversial videos that violate the terms of service. But the fact is that Ethan Klein's interview of Jordan Peterson did not violate the terms of service. So he was doing it on the pretense that that talking to Jordan Peterson makes you a alt-right pipeline. Absolutely ridiculous argument. It's like, if you were really just about respecting the TOS, you delete those videos that violate the rules, and you don't smear Jordan Peterson in the process. But Jordan answered, "You will be held to higher and higher and soon impossible to maintain ethical standards by the very mob you currently wish to please. Then you will make a mistake and they will devour you," Dr. Peterson said. Very nice words, because I found myself, you know, having to respect speech rules on YouTube and thinking at the beginning, all right, well, a little rule like this, I can censor myself. And then eventually more rules came in, and eventually the algorithm just added so much rules that there was not a single sentence that I couldn't that I could say just the way it came in my brain. There wasn't a single sentence that I didn't have to censor in some way. So it becomes unviable, and Ethan Klein should think about it. Poll finds close to half of Democratic voters want COVID internment camps for the unvaxxed. A national poll has found that 45% of likely Democratic voters would be okay with the government requiring citizens to temporarily live in designated facilities or locations if they refuse to get a COVID-19 vaccine. I mean, when we were saying we are surrounded by a bunch of communist fascists, it may have sounded alarming when we were saying this years ago, but it's literally what's happening. We are surrounded by extremely dangerous individuals who are up for the gulag. They feel like our world is missing gulags, and they're totally open to the idea. Prison camps, let's do it. As Katie says, "We were suffering with you on YouTube, JF. Your unfiltered speech is part and parcel of the resistance. Would you ever have written TRP on YouTube today? I don't see it." Yeah, you're right. And, you know, I'm not unhappy about having suffered through. In a way, it's good to feel the extent of the oppression. It's good to have went through years of cognitive oppression by Susan Wojcicki, because now I know how it feels exactly. I know just how much we're losing when we lose liberty. I'm happy to have done it. "Would you date a leftist woman?" That was my question, since Academic Agent was recommending not to. 7 people have answered no. 1 person has answered yes. Yes, extremely dangerous. Do it only in circumstances where humanity is about to get extinguished and you are the only viable reproductive couple left alive. Outside of these circumstances, try to avoid. I'm making some advance on arguably.io. So arguably.io is a new encyclopedia that I've started. I have the server right here. Let me give you the link to the encyclopedia. If you want to participate to this, the goal is to create a tree of all possible beliefs and knowledge and say, why is that wrong? Is that true? Is that possibly true? Is that a truth that depends on a particular definition, which is false? I create a world of dependency. A world of dependency between all possible truths, wrong, true, and possible. And I've given some examples. So I've created some article to give you an idea of what this could be about. I've been reviewing some, you know, some articles at Associated Press that claim to be fact-checking, and they claim to be fact-checking the claim Viagra can cure COVID. And I go on to explain, well, here are the ways in which the fact-check doesn't work. Here's the fallacy. Here's that. If you want to start contributing to it, it's open. You can create an account at the upper right corner and you just start writing. I would like to see you guys develop stuff so that we can be faced with beginning drafts and we can know exactly what the structure of the overall wiki should be. But the goal is, I look at Wikipedia and it doesn't work. They've decided to adopt only one truth. And I want a wiki that can represent all possible truths. I want a wiki that explains why is it that, you know, the theory that COVID doesn't exist, why it's wrong, and what are the evidence that you have to deny for reaching that conclusion. And so you'll see in the way I structured my tables, when you create an article, you end up with a table like this. So the claim Viagra can cure COVID, well, I mark it as possible with some support, and I explain what the support is. We have factual, the nature of the claim can be either factual, ethical, theoretical, or there's a fourth one. In any case, we are dividing the world of claims in all of the categories that they could potentially be. And you know, for example, if you want to believe that Viagra can cure COVID-19, well, you first have to believe that SARS-CoV-2 exists. So we have dependency relationships between the tree of knowledge. And eventually, once we have hundreds of thousands of pages on there, you'll be like, okay, let's say the idea that there are infinitely many primes. What does it rely on? What are the first principles you have to accept to reach that conclusion? That is the goal. We will create a mega gigantic tree of all human beliefs. If you want to participate to it, just open an account and you go for any subject you'd like. I would like eventually to have a complete, essentially, encyclopedia of epistemology and belief. That is it for tonight, boys. I will see you all tomorrow. Join the channel, subscribe to the Odyssey. For those of you who complained about buffering, it sometimes happens on Odyssey. Don't forget to turn off your VPN. It can greatly help. And if you still have problems, there is an MP3 link in the description below. Now, all our shows are available for direct download in MP3. You will not get to see my face, but you will hear my voice and hear our guests. So that's an option for those of you who have low bandwidth. Alogon says, what if I believe that there is no COVID, but that Viagra can cure? I can add this, yes, exactly. That's the kind of all possible combination I'd like to see. Can you maintain a position in which you would say SARS-CoV-2 doesn't exist, but Viagra cures whatever problem is attributed to SARS-CoV-2? If anyone out there has ever expressed this view, quote them, explain their argument. Of course, I wouldn't want to see arguments in there that are held by no one. Ultimately, it matters, but I have no, you know, notability criteria. I think any argument that can potentially make sense should be included. Most importantly, any argument that's ever been adopted by someone. Anyone who's written a blog post about something, include it in there. I'd like to see the structure of knowledge develop in front of us and all of the sorts of interpretation. This will be awesome. I see that someone just created a page, apparently during the show. Germany is responsible for World War One. Wow, that is not something I had even considered, that we would be doing claims about who's responsible. Is it a factual claim or is it an ethical claim? We'll have to, that's exactly the kind of thing I want to figure out. Skatey says, JF, I believe it would be possible to render the entirety of the archive of the server into algorithms which graphitize or create 3D anatomies of connections network in order to gain a physical rendering of the connections. My friend, you are ahead of your time. I'm going to show you a preview of what some volunteer has decided to start developing a front end to do exactly what you just described. A browser of the structure of knowledge. Of course, this is a model. It's not yet plugged to the wiki. It comes from the web. But we'll be able to say, all right, this belief connects to this belief. This belief depends on this belief. He's currently working on this, and it will look something like this, with trees of nested dependencies between beliefs, falsity, truth. It will all be in front of our eyes. James Babcock says, when is the next Patreon hangout? You're right. I forgot to schedule the Patreon hangout. Let's do it right now. Let's schedule it on the 19th. Patreon hangout. Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern time. I've added it to the calendar. It will be in 2 days from now. All right, everyone, sleep well, much love, and see you all tomorrow.